The Iranian president says the U.S. should be held accountable for supporting the Daesh terror group, as well as new forms of terrorism. Russia says the agreed goal of Vienna talks to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is removing anti-Tehran sanctions. Also, a former U.S. Marine has killed four people, including a woman and her three-month-old baby boy near Lakeland, Florida. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the Iranian president says the U.S. should be held accountable for supporting the Daesh terror group as well as new forms of terrorism. In a phone conversation with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron, Ebrahim Raisi stated that Daesh was created and is backed by Washington. Raisi decried the policy adopted by some countries that categorize terrorism into good and bad. He added that Iran condemns terror in any shape or form and makes no distinction between terrorist groups. The Iranian president further underlined that the United States and NATO's policy of military intervention in Afghanistan was a failure. He stressed that everyone should help establish an all-inclusive government in Kabul, which brings together all Afghan groups. Macron, in turn, said his country stands ready to open a new chapter in its relations with Iran. Russia says the agreed goal of Vienna talks to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is removing anti-Tehran sanctions. In a tweet, Russia's permanent representative to the international organizations in Vienna, Mikhail Lyanov, said all participants in the negotiations agree that the talks are aimed at restoring the original accord. He added that a possible restoration would include full implementation of the signatories' commitments under the deal. He was reacting to Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who said, "The plan for and the goal of the talks must be the removal of sanctions against this country." Former U.S. Senator Richard Black says external influences on the U.S. Congress can impede any progress in removing anti-Iran sanctions. Let's listen.
Iran negotiated in good faith with the other parties, including the United States. They all made compromises. They came to an agreement, and that was moving forward. And then there was a unilateral withdrawal by the United States. So I can understand where there is a feeling within Iran that, look, we stuck with the agreement, we fulfilled our obligations, and so if we're going to talk about starting them up again, we should start off with the same agreement we had. I understand that. I think that's a very persuasive argument. I think they would be willing to try to drop sanctions to the extent they can. But again, they have political pressures on them regarding the sanctions, and Congress is pretty deeply involved. So I don't think the greatest problem is with President Biden. I think the greater problem is sort of with this deep state apparatus, where you have people who profit from a continuing state of hostilities in the Middle East.
Ahmad Massoud, the leader of the National Resistance Front of Afghanistan, says he is open to peace talks if the Taliban withdraw their forces from the region. Massoud says his forces are ready to stop fighting on condition that the Taliban also halt their attacks and military movements in Panjshir and Andarab. Meanwhile, a general of the anti-Taliban forces as well as their spokesperson, Fahim Dashti, were killed on Sunday. The developments come after Taliban forces claimed they had fought their way into the provincial capital of Panjshir after securing the surrounding districts. Religious scholars have called on the Taliban to accept a negotiated settlement to end the fighting in Panjshir. So far, however, there has been no response from the Taliban.
Taliban have deployed more troops and military hardware to the northeastern Panjshir Valley to take the last remaining territory in Afghanistan from the National Resistance Front headed by Ahmed Massoud, the son of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmed Shah Massoud. Massoud has called for a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, but has said his forces will resist if the narrow and mountainous valley is attacked. Meanwhile, some top political leaders urge both sides to set aside differences and resume a meaningful negotiation in a bid to avoid dangerous scenarios, mainly the loss of civilian lives in Panjshir, as well as a spread of armed resistance across the rest of provinces.
The only way of the ongoing situation in Panjshir is to simultaneously resume meaningful negotiations and continue resistance against any totalitarian policy to pave the way for establishment of an inclusive government.
This is while the expansion of war has forced hundreds of local villagers to flee their houses. They call on the international community and especially the UN to convince both sides to resume negotiations.
The war has forced us to flee our village and come to Kabul. I have 5 children. We have nowhere to go but city parks. We want peace. Our children should take up their education in a calm atmosphere. So I want Massoud and Taliban to stop their war machines.
The possible fall of Panjshir Valley into the hands of Taliban will bring the entire country under the rule of Taliban for the first time, as they couldn't capture Panjshir Valley during their first rule in Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001.
The war on Panjshir has turned into a big headache for the Taliban. Moreover, the group's leaders have so far failed to reach an agreement on the formation of the new government in Kabul. The Taliban have postponed the move again, saying they need more time for final consultations among the group's top leaders. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A growing number of civil society organizations and rights groups are calling on the European Union to take in more Afghan refugees. Our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, has been gauging the opinions of citizens in the Belgian capital, Brussels. Here's more.
Across the world, the Afghan crisis continues to be a major talking point. It's no different here in the EU's de facto capital, Brussels. Members of the public have been sharing their views with Press TV.
I think we should leave the country and try for themselves to come out of it.
We should not intervene sometimes in proposing democracy or the sorts of political situations where they're not in, when the country is not ready.
Especially the United States did in this country. It makes it worse, I think.
Now they are taking all of the materials, but I think as a global community we should interfere, but to stop that.
Power and interference always go together.
Anti-war campaigners are furious at remarks made by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell last Thursday. He said Afghanistan proves the need for an expanded EU military force, more commonly referred to as the EU Army.
We have to step up our integrated approach, combining military, civilian, development and diplomatic efforts.
We have been speaking to citizens about Afghans who are desperate to seek asylum. EU leaders, they don't want more refugees. Do you think we should take more refugees in?
Yes, he needs. He needs to take more refugees because these people are in bad situation in their country.
Belgian people or European people say that we don't have enough place, but I think we have.
We must take refugees because all the people are on the same world. We are the same world.
They need to offer that help, and I believe that they need to offer a place to stay because they have nowhere else to stay.
The policy of occupying nations against their will certainly didn't go well in Afghanistan. Top EU officials and also prime ministers in the 27-country bloc are saying lessons must be learned. A good start, critics argue, would be for the EU to stop responding how high when Washington shouts, jump. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
former U.S. Marine has killed four people, including a woman and her three-month-old baby boy near Lakeland, Florida. The shooter, identified as Brian Riley, also wounded an 11-year-old girl who has undergone surgery for seven gunshot injuries. Riley, who had no connection to the victims, engaged in a shootout with police before giving up. After being detained, he also tried to grab a police officer's gun while being treated in the hospital for his gunshot wound. The suspect, who was high on methamphetamine, was reportedly suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and occasional depression. A veteran of the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Riley was working as a bodyguard and a security guard. Special Forces soldiers have overthrown Guinea's long-serving President Alpha Condé, saying they have dissolved the country's government and constitution. Elite Army unit's head, Mamadi Doumbouya, said poverty and endemic corruption had driven his forces to remove Condé from office. Doumbouya said on state television that his forces have closed the country's land and air borders. The junta also announced a nationwide curfew until further notice, as well as the replacement of governors by the military. Meanwhile, the African Union has condemned the military takeover in Guinea, demanding immediate liberation of the president. Condé's whereabouts are not known. He won a third term in October after changing the constitution to allow him to stand again. That led to violent protests spearheaded by the opposition. Political commentator Abayomi Azikiwa says the special forces soldiers in Guinea have been trained by France and the United States.
This new military takeover is carried out by a group of elite military officers where initial preliminary reports indicate that they were trained by France as well as the United States. So this is not a good development for Guinea, even though the president that has been arrested, Alpha Condé, was very much pro-French and pro-U.S. There are opposition groups in Guinea who opposed the ousted president Alpha Condé's changing of the constitution to allow him to run for a third term. There was tremendous opposition to that. He was re-elected last year. And so many of the opposition forces inside the country are welcoming the coup. Now, these officers claim they're establishing a national committee for reconciliation and development. Yet, the whole world is suffering from an economic crisis now, post-COVID-19 pandemic. And a lot of these military officers opportunistically take advantage of the economic crisis. We saw the same situation in Mali, and we've also seen a similar situation in Chad as well over the last year. So the African Union has condemned this. The economic community of West African states will condemn this. But the question is, do they have the authority and do they have the capacity to reverse this military seizure of power?
Yemen's army says it has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in various areas of Saudi Arabia with a dozen of drones and ballistic missiles. Abdul Latif Awashili has more in the following report.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with eight drones of Samad 3 type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with eight Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan, and Najran were also successfully hit by five ballistic missiles and two drones of Samad 3 type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Indian farmers have held a massive rally in Uttar Pradesh province to protest against the government's agricultural reforms. More than 500,000 farmers attended the rally. That's the biggest in a series of such demonstrations in India over the past months. The protests began ever since the government introduced the agricultural reforms last September. It says the reforms will help farmers get better prices. The farmers, however, say the measures favor private retailers and food processors. Thousands of them have also camped on major highways to the capital, New Delhi. Over the past months, they pressured the government to abandon the reforms. Iran's Covpars vaccine has entered the third human trial stage. The recombinant vaccine will be the third Iranian-made jab that has reached this phase. Youssef Jalali reports.
Among the seven Iranian COVID vaccines, Covpars is making a name for itself. Developed by Razi Serum and Vaccine Research Institute, the recombinant vaccine started the third human trial phase on Sunday.
In this phase, we are going to have 40,000 people in two groups, one receiving Sinopharm, and the other, the Razi Covpars. We are going to compare the number of people who are going to get sick in each group, and by comparing with each other, what we are hoping to show is that the efficacy of our vaccine is at least the same as the Sinopharm.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 10% of its population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms, like the Delta variant, has been killing an average of around 500 Iranians every day in the past month. As the government is scrambling to import more vaccines, Covpars authorities say they're working to get an emergency use license to help speed up the inoculation program.
Given the restrictions imposed by U.S. sanctions on the way of vaccine imports to Iran, we need to boost our domestic production of COVID vaccines. So we are expecting that Covpars will get the emergency use license halfway through the third trial stage.
Covpars is administered in three doses, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and one intranasal shot 1 month after the second dose. Covpars says if all goes based on the plan, the vaccine will hit the market in 6 months. As the coronavirus keeps transforming into wilder variants, Covpars developers say they've already launched their production line to speed up the vaccination process. The biotech firm says as soon as it gets the emergency use license, it will kick off mass production with a capacity of 3 million doses per month. Youssef Jalali, Alborz Province.
Well, that does it for this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Though U.S. forces have left Afghanistan, the war could continue with remotely controlled drone strikes and even less accountability. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Murtaza Hussein, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. drone strike in Kabul killed a family and began a new chapter of war. Stay tuned for more. The recent drone strike in Kabul, initially claimed by U.S. officials to have destroyed a car packed with multiple suicide bombers, reportedly killed 10 civilians from one family, including several children. The drone strike that hit Khaja Berga, a working-class residential neighborhood in Kabul, was said to have killed numerous members of Ahmadi family, with the youngest alleged victim being a 2-year-old girl. Morgue footage shared on social media showed the burnt bodies of several children as well as photos of the victims before their deaths. One of the dead, according to members of the Ahmadi family who spoke to reporters, was a former Afghan military officer who had served as a contractor for U.S. forces as well as a worker at a charity organization. The Americans said the airstrike killed Daesh members. A neighbor of the family angrily told reporters after the strike, referring to Daesh. Where is Daesh here? Were these children Daesh? The U.S. Defense Department and other arms of the Biden administration continue to describe the drone attack as a successful strike against Daesh, which had taken responsibility for a suicide bombing at a Kabul airport. As reports confirm that an innocent family had been killed, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said that the Department of Defense is not in a position to dispute reports that civilians were killed, stating that the incident would be investigated. The Kabul drone strike is just one in a long string of attacks in Afghanistan by U.S. forces and their proxies, reported to have killed large numbers of civilians. Past attacks have hit families traveling in cars and buses, wedding parties, hospitals filled with patients, and groups of farmers working in the fields. While the withdrawal of American troops can be described as the end to the war in Afghanistan, the Kabul strike shows how the war may simply enter a new chapter, with the U.S. striking targets with aircraft launched from faraway drone bases. Critics of civilian casualties in U.S. war have pointed to the lack of serious investigations on the ground to the deaths, accountability that will even harder to come by in a remote war. The drone program is opaque, with extremely limited accountability for anyone involved. In my experience, the bar for thorough military investigation has been so high as to discount a majority of credible incidents. What investigations do take place are neither consistent rigors, said Nick McDonnell, author of The Bodies in Person, an account of civilian casualties in American wars, an analysis of the impact of the U.S. air wars in the West Asia region. Adding, at the same time, the military has repeatedly suppressed information on civilian casualties. The drone program is opaque, with extremely limited accountability for anyone involved. What separated the recent Kabul drone strike from the long pattern of reported civilian deaths was the level of immediate attention and outrage it has generated. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has mostly been waged in rural areas away from the attention of international media. Kabul, on the other hand, is the highly populated capital and the country's center for expatriates, non-governmental organizations, and both Afghan as well as international journalists. When the strike was reported, immediate video footage of the civilians who were killed in the attack began to circulate, and even international journalists were able to quickly access the attack site. In contrast, many past strikes have gone under the radar and continue to do so. A retaliatory strike that came immediately after the recent terrorist attack at Hamid Karzai International Airport hit rural eastern Afghanistan, allegedly killing 2 people, an ISIS planner and a facilitator, according to the Defense Department. At a press briefing recently, Kirby declined to share further information about the identities of the two people allegedly killed in that prior attack. Other than dedicated Afghanistan observers, few took notice. Journalists and rights advocates have so far not reported any details of on-the-ground investigations or if such investigations are even possible. The opaque nature of the war in Afghanistan has made calculating accurate death tolls from U.S. operations difficult, a challenge that has been compounded by the military's own long-standing refusal to compile statistics and verify information about who is killed in its strikes. The secretive nature of the war on terror in general, across all its various theaters of operation, coupled with military practices that devote little attention to strike investigations, makes assessing civilian impact nearly impossible. The U.S. military's own promises to investigate civilian casualty incidents have resulted in little meaningful accountability in the past. According to its standard practices, the military does not conduct site visits to learn who was killed in its airstrikes, leaving the grueling work of finding out who died and why to independent monitoring organizations and investigative journalists who operate with far fewer resources than the Pentagon. The Washington Post reported recently that as airstrikes ramped up in the final years of the Afghanistan war, the number of strikes investigated by the military for civilian casualties plummeted. Few outside the areas impacted would have taken notice of many of the strikes at all, let alone the absence of investigations. In those cases in which the military did launch its own inquiries, the findings were viewed with skepticism. These investigations are nothing but advertisements to the media, a local council official from Helmand province in Afghanistan told the Post. They have no mercy. They only see targets to kill. The Kabul airstrike, though, generated an outpouring of grief and anger among many Afghans, already reeling from the Taliban takeover of their country following the collapse of the U.S.-backed central government. Though the Pentagon has promised to hold itself accountable for such incidents, experts on the drone war say that there is little reason, based on the past practice, to expect meaningful justice for the victims. Hena Shamsi, director of the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project, said the failure to properly acknowledge, investigate, or compensate civilian deaths and injuries is one constant of U.S. airstrikes, whether in recognized wars like Afghanistan or outside of them, like in Somalia. Adding, the specific reasons and the agencies involved in those failures may differ in each context. And over 20 years, we have repeatedly seen legal and policy debates and promises by the U.S. government to do better. But that's of little comfort to the civilians on the receiving end of American lethal force who suffer terrible harm with little or no transparency and accountability.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and how about listening to a bezel of wisdom from the Prophet's fourth infallible heir, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him. The best key for all affairs is truth, and the best end of all affairs is faithfulness and loyalty.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam alaikum, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batul. Welcome to the program for a better life. First of all, what is a better life? The answer is when a person is happy. Now, this happiness is not the material happiness, but it is the happiness of the soul. So how can I reach this happiness? The answer is when I become a better person. Therefore, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. So how can I become a better person? In the very first session, we said that the first step to become a better person is yaqda, which is to wake up. Now, wake up from what? Wake up from my deep sleep of negligence. Wake up from ghafla. Ayatollah Jawadi Amli said that the solution to the problem of ghafla was two things. One, to take care of our thoughts, and two, to remember Allah constantly, to do dhikr. In the previous session, we said that when we recite the dhikr, Subhanallahi walhamdulillahi wa la ilaha illallah wallahu akbar, Allah creates four birds that will glorify Him till Qiyamah. So brothers and sisters, man sometimes, like Prophet Isa alayhi salam, can become a manifestation of Allah's attribute. Isa alayhi salam created a bird from clay with the leave of Allah. Look, just like Allah, even He created, but with the leave of Allah. And Allah talks about it in Surah Maida, verse 110. He says, وَإِذْ تَخْلُقُ مِنَ الْتِينِ كَحَيَّةِ الطَّيْرِ بِإِذْنِي فَتَنْفُقُ فِيهَا فَتَكُونُ طَيْرًا بِإِذْنِي.
And when you would create from clay the form of a bird with my leave, and you would breathe into it, and it would become a bird with my leave, yani with my permission. And sometimes in the soul of the one who is doing dhikr, birds are created. And without clay, that glorify Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When one creates such a bird, he becomes a manifestation of Allah's attribute. And which attribute? The attribute of creation, the attribute of qaliqiyat. That means he becomes a creator. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said that when Prophet Yahya alayhi salam said, Ya Rabbi, Ya Allah, Allah replied, Labbaik Ya Abdi, Sal Hajatak, meaning, here I am, my servant, ask what you want. In regards to this, Allah said in Quran, وَحَنَانًا مِنْ لَدُنَّا, and a compassion from us. So Allah said that His compassion was descended on Yahya alayhi salam. In return, Yahya alayhi salam was compassionate too. This is what Prophet Yahya taught us. He told us, you also say Ya Allah and listen to the Labbaik from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is also narrated, brothers and sisters, that if you have a wish, recite Ya Allah 10 times and ask what you want, and Allah will answer your prayers. That means I just say 10 times, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah. I say 10 times and then I ask what I want and Allah will answer my prayers. So this is how our imams taught us the way of Isa alayhi salam, where you can create those boats with your worship, and Yahya alayhi salam, who said, Ya Allah, Ya Rabbi, and Allah says, Labbaik. If we follow their path, then we will be blessed with divine help too. Now, we'll get back after a short break.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, to the program For a Better Life. And we were talking about the path of Isa alayhi salam and Yahya alayhi salam, where Isa alayhi salam created a bird with clay with the permission of Allah, and how Yahya alayhi salam used to say, Ya Allah, Ya Rabbi, Ya Allah, and Allah would say, Labbaik. And there are many traditions that say that with every drop of water that is used for wudu, an angel is created. This also displays the path of Isa alayhi salam, where he created, and now we can create with wudu. But if someone is negligent in their salat and prays negligently, then his wudu for his salat was done negligently too. However, nothing is created with such a wudu and such a salat. In fact, such a salat is an example of the words, فَوَيْلُ لِلْمُصَلِّينَ, woe to them who pray, الَّذِينَ هُمْ أَنْ صَلَاتِهِمْ سَاهُونَ, those are heedless of their prayers. So for this wudu, a person who does negligently, it should be said, in the same manner it should be said, فَوَيْلُ لِلْمُطَحَّرِينَ, woe to them who do the taharat, who cleanse themselves, الَّذِينَ هُمْ أَنْ طَحَارَتِهِمْ سَاهُونَ, those who are heedless of their tahara, of their cleanliness, of their purification, of their wudu. Therefore, an angel is not created with the drops of such a wudu. Some might object, saying, how is it possible for a man to be a creator? Such a person has not believed in the words of the imams. We have plenty authentic narrations from the imams that confirm that angels are created with the worship of the wayfarer, the salik. Unfortunately, such a person has still not believed that man with the right and correct worship with his sahih salat and sahih wudu with a sahih ibadah, he can also follow the path of Isa alayhi salam by creating. He does not have to be a prophet or an imam. He can do what Isa alayhi salam did and become a manifestation of Allah's attribute of creativity. For example, Shamun, who is also called Simon, he was the disciple and the successor of Isa alayhi salam. He also performed miracles of Isa alayhi salam with the leaf of Allah, of course. One of the followers of Isa alayhi salam walked with him on water. And when he was walking, remember the story, it's a very famous story. What happened? He started thinking, halfway he goes and he goes like, oh, I'm also doing what Isa does. So I'm also doing what a prophet does. And he started getting proud. And right then, he started drowning. And he goes like, whoa, 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 Isa, help me. And Isa alayhi salam pulls him out and says, did you think about something that you should not be thinking? And the man repents and he says like, yes, I started feeling proud. And he repents. And then he starts walking on the water with Isa alayhi salam. So there are many more examples as such. We just have to believe in them. So if we do the right worship, like the right salat, the right wudu, when I say right, I mean without being negligent, then we can also be creator of angels. So let us pray to Allah that He gives us the tawfiq to worship Him with all our heart and soul and to become a better person. And when I become a better person, that will lead me to have a better life, insha'Allah. Wa akhiru da'wahum anilhamdu lillahi rabbil alameen.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So all I need. All I need. All I need. So
the light.
Young generations are becoming more concerned about our planet and seem determined to contribute to make it environmentally friendly. A great example is this Parisian boy who spends a lot of time fishing metals out of rivers and canals in the French capital. Good for him. 11-year-old Raphael uses magnets and grappling irons to fish metal objects out of the Seine River in Paris. Over the past 2 years, he has taken hundreds of bikes, scooters, and shopping trolleys out of the water. The boy says the practice was initially a hobby for him, but it eventually turned into a reasonability and a method to raise awareness about climate and environmental issues.
My goal is to raise awareness so that a maximum of people do something. They don't have to do what I do, but at least do something. Even if it's not necessarily cleaning up canals, it could just be picking up a cigarette butt.
Raphael has also fished some very rare items out of different canals, including handguns, pieces of jewelry, and an artillery shell. An exhibition is therefore being held in Paris where Raphael's findings are going to be put on display. The young environmentalist has also been awarded the Medal of Paris, a prize belonging to the residents who accomplish a deed concerning the city. Brazilian researchers have discovered a substance that could be used as a drug against COVID-19, and you may not like where they found it. A group of scientists have come across a potentially life-saving molecule in the venom of a kind of Brazilian pit viper. It is a peptide or a chain of amino acids that limited reproduction of the coronavirus in monkey cells by 75%. The peptide can be synthesized in the laboratory, so there is no need to capture more vipers. Now the researchers will evaluate whether the molecule can be used to create medicine for treating people with COVID-19. Thousands of cows have descended from their summer quarters in the Swiss Alps to enjoy the warm temperatures of lower heights. The cattle herds spent 7 weeks in the Alpine Mountains, grazing at an altitude of nearly 2,000 meters. Their journey down started before sunrise and took almost 5 hours to complete. The cows, which couldn't make the trek due to injury, had already been carried down using trucks and helicopters. Farming has found an alternative look in the Netherlands, where cows produce milk on an eco-friendly floating farm. That may seem a surreal image of Rotterdam, the largest port in Europe. A herd of cows peacefully feed on board of what is known as the world's first floating farm. They live on the top floor of the three-story farm, while their milk is turned into dairy products on the other two floors. The floating farm opened in 2019. The owners say it aims to show the future of breeding and farming.
You must realize that the world is under pressure. Therefore, we have less and less land, agricultural land. Our idea is that in this way, we can actually create agricultural land close to the city and also adaptable to the climate.
The floating farm is seen as a good alternative for normal farming in the Netherlands. That's a country with scarce land while being threatened by climate change. The farm's owners have also applied eco-friendly methods to make it durable and self-sufficient as much as possible. The methods include using solar panels and feeding the cows with grass from sports fields.
An Australian cyclist has become the first woman in history to pull off a front flip on a mountain bike. Caroline Birkenen landed the front flip at the OD9 cycling event in the German city of Birkenfeld. The maneuver won the former two-time Olympian the women's best trick title in the event. This was the first time the nines featured a female category. The annual event gathers the world's best slopestyle and freeride mountain cyclists to Germany. A spectacular light show has mesmerized people in a Greek capital, Athens. 200 colorful drones performed a short harmonized display illuminating the night sky. Their colors and shapes were changing alongside music tracks. The show, organized by the Athens Cultural Center, took place 120 meters above the National Opera and Library. An Afghan woman has received the gift of life at a most unlikely time while flying. 26-year-old Saman Nouri was on a plane bound for Birmingham when she started having contractions. She gave birth to a little girl in an altitude of 10,000 meters with the help of the cabin crew. Born in Kuwaiti airspace, the baby is named Hawa, which means Eve or Air in Dari. Both mother and daughter are completely healthy. The aircraft was carrying Afghan citizens evacuated from Kabul. The passengers left behind their old lives, but were gifted with a new one in the process. After all, life does find a way. French graffiti artist has created a monumental mountaintop project to encourage a more contemplative approach to life, aiming at lifting people's spirits. The giant 1,500 square meter painting is called A New Lease of Life. It was painted on the summit of Mollison Peak in the western Swiss Alps. The 32-year-old artist says he was inspired by the likeness of childlike wonder. The mural depicts a little boy blowing bubbles in an area known for its clouds. The artist says he wanted to reflect the link between children and sky gazing.
I think we live in a world that includes anxiety, and we need a little lightness to balance it. So I believe that the clouds mean dreams and imagination. When we were kids, we liked to imagine shapes in the clouds and so on. And I believe that this is a moment where we have to breathe and also imagine the world of tomorrow with a certain lightness through daydreaming.
Saip also says he designs his creations to fit in with the environment using biodegradable paints made from natural pigments. The French artist is known for his massive graffiti works on grass that are best seen from the air. Some of his other works have adorned an impoverished shanty town in South Africa and the lawn in front of the UN headquarters in Geneva. One of Mexico's largest zoos has launched a one-of-a-kind exhibition, with the star of the show being a manatee couple. Visitors will be able to see the couple at the new exhibition, which is part of the largest aquarium in the country. The zoo received the manatee couple from the Caribbean with the intention of raising awareness for the protection of the species. Part of the ticket proceeds will go toward conservation efforts. Manatees are fully aquatic, mostly herbivorous marine mammals that are sometimes known as sea cows. These funny-looking creatures are endangered because of pollution and fishing techniques.
Paleontologists in Egypt have discovered fossilized bones of an ancient whale that could probably walk on land and swim in water. Scientists found the skull, jaw, and some ribs and identified the parts as the 43-million-year-old ancestor of the modern whale. It's also the earliest type of semi-aquatic whale found in Africa. The whale is estimated to have been 10 meters in length, weighing over half a ton, and was likely a top predator. Scientists say the four-legged whale is a key new species that helps trace the transition of whales from land to sea. Paleontologists believe that the ancestors of modern whales developed from deer-like mammals living on land over a 10-million-year period. The fossilized remains were discovered in Egypt's western desert, which was once covered by sea. A French beekeeper has invented a unique device to keep his beehives safe after suffering a traumatic loss of 35 of them to hungry Asian hornets. The device is a one-way mechanism that baits hornets with sugary water, and once they get in through a funnel, they never come out. Originally, the trap was made of wooden crates and metal mesh, but now they are 3D printed in plastic. Dennis made his first lobster pot to catch the hornets in 2016 and now makes the traps in bulk due to growing demand. The Asian hornets are an invasive insect that arrived in France via a pottery shipment from China. The killer hornet can eat through an entire hive in a matter of hours. There is a festive occasion for a Mexican zoo amid a rare birth boom in its lion enclosure. Keepers and visitors are amazed to hear roars of three newborn cubs. The three baby lions that are trying very hard to roar were born just 2 weeks ago in Zacango Zoo. The zookeepers separate them from their mother for a few hours a day to feed them because their mother cannot produce milk. The two female and male cubs would live under constant surveillance for a couple of months so that their health is reassured. They are reported to be currently in good health.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A bunker built by the German army in France during World War II has now been given a new lease of life by turning it into an underground guest house. A 4,300 square feet bunker located off Breton coast in northern France was originally built by Nazi troops after invading the country in 1940. The area has been the home of hundreds of such fortifications of the German army. Half of them have been buried along sandy beaches. This underground guest house now belongs to the 52-year-old bunker enthusiast. Serge Goliot says it took 18 months to dig out the buried trench and turn it into a fully functional guest house. He says an attempt was made to preserve some historic aspects during its renovation.
What is nice is to now be able to spend time here, to have dinner, to spend the night in things like this. So we adapted the bunker while preserving a certain feel. We wanted to give the building a second life, so we are not going to live in the past forever. We save some aspects, you know, where you are. There are historic cues, but this isn't a museum either.
Colliot says many French visitors and foreigners, including Germans, have stayed in the guest house since the bunker opened a year ago. The world's highest expressway has opened to traffic in China's Tibet Autonomous Region. It's nearly 300 kilometers long and has an average elevation of 4,500 meters. It connects the cities of Nanchu and Lhasa, shortening the travel time from 6 to 3 hours. The road passes through many picturesque areas, such as snowy mountains, grasslands, and wetlands. The expressway is also environmentally friendly. Special passages have been devised for animals to get from one side of the freeway to the other. An architectural firm in Singapore has come up with a unique idea to deal with the country's constant warm temperatures. A hotel on the island's busy business district has been covered with more than 20 species of creeping plants to keep the place cooler. A layer of vegetation blankets the facade of the Red Tower, which is growing thicker with the passage of time. The plants reduce the ambient temperature by a combination of water evaporation and releasing cooler vapor. The architect says the tower is 10 to 20 degrees Celsius cooler than nearby buildings. The green facades also reduce harmful carbon emissions, which account for over 20% in a sprawling city.
The youngest panda at the U.S.'s Smithsonian Zoo, National Zoo that is, has turned one. Baby panda Xiao Qiji celebrates the milestone by eating a specially made fruitsicle cake with his mother, Mei Xiang, in Washington, D.C. Both pandas dug into their icy cake, an ideal treat in the hot and humid summers of the U.S. capital. Xiao has captured hearts and had many first-time experiences. Some of them include sliding and tumbling around in snow and recognizing his name, which translates to little miracle in English.
He was born during the pandemic, and given the age of his mother, we didn't think she'd have another